brought to you by Canonical, Microsoft, Apple, Google, Mission Burritos, the Conservative Party, and everyone else that you say bankrolls us. This is the Tux Radar Podcast, Season 3, Episode 6. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Efrain Hernandez.
And I'm Graham Morrison.
Excellent. And in this episode, we'll be talking about GNOME, Ubuntu, GTK 3.2, the Debian Derivatives Exchange. We'll have our challengers. We'll have Graham in the dock trying to advocate something. And of course, the results of the open ballot. If you love this podcast, you will absolutely, definitely, ganz bestimmt love our magazine, Linux Format, which you can subscribe to at tuxradar.com/subscribe.
Linux Format ist meine Lieblingsmagazin.
Wirklich?
Ja.
Wirklich?
Die besten Linux Magazin in der alles der Welt.
Der ganzen Welt. Prima.
Me gusta.
So, let's get straight into the news. And a big story in the last couple of weeks. There's been like a collection of stories and blog posts on the internet with talking about GNOME not collaborating with the other desktop environments. Mark Shuttleworth posted an entry on his blog talking about that, saying that Unity, the new interface for Ubuntu, was designed as a shell for GNOME. He says, "We wanted to be sure that whatever competitive dynamics arose were internal to GNOME and thus contributing to a better result overall in GNOME in the long term." But it looks like a lot of GNOME developers aren't seeing it this way, and they're seeing it as a direct challenge to them.
Yeah, well, I suppose what GNOME developers are going to be looking for kind of upstream commits to their code base, and there aren't any. and as I recall, I can't remember, I think it was Guadec or something like that in about 2007, where the GNOME developers were talking about GNOME 3.0. I'll just switch to GNOME. And they discussed Ubuntu's UNR interface, what became Unity, and I think that was their kind of motivation for GNOME Shell. And
right.
They must have assumed that Canonical would be on board when it came to everybody working together for a GNOME 3 shell, a new desktop shell. And it's quite shocking, really, that we have two projects that are just so similar and yet completely separate.
Yeah, this does seem to be causing a lot of arguments in the community. And then Aaron Zago, he chipped in with another blog post, and he said that GNOME developers have, quote, "lost the sight of the goal of a coherent experience for users of free software, regardless of the applications they choose to use." And a lot of this seems to have stemmed from some libnotification, or some library to do with...
Well, wasn't that Canonical? Well, so was that, what was that... what was Aaron referring to, do you know?
As I understand it, just talking about GNOME's lack of collaboration in these notification library and status applets and things like that, and the overall lack of collaboration between the desktops.
I think a lot of this, in previous Aaron posts, where I think libnotify, the notification system that Ubuntu Canonical developed for their, you know, the pop-up information things that appear in Ubuntu whenever you do something half interesting or, in fact, not interesting at all. That is one of the successes they've had. In fact, one of the very few in actually getting something ratified and put into GNOME. And when it gets put into GNOME, it also needs to go into the freedesktop.org kind of... whatever you call it. And then from freedesktop.org, the standard gets filtered back down to KD if they want to implement their own notification system, which they did. So I think what Aaron may be talking about is the difficulties they had in getting some sensible answers and a single standard for a notification system that the KD team could then develop so that both GNOME and KD could have a single notification experience. And I think he said that even as recently as the last 6 months, everything's changed. The KD team found it very difficult to get their ideas across and to get their changes made to the standard. It all seemed, freedesktop.org, it all seemed very GNOME-centric.
Right.
The idea of wanting to generate competition within GNOME rather than competing with GNOME, it sounds rather like the Conservative Party's ideas for generating competition within the NHS.
Oh, yes, really?
Which is going spiffingly well. Other political parties are available.
We're going to have to get a new sponsor now.
And I think you'll find it's the same on the rail network, where the Conservative Party are also trying to change the way that we travel.
But back on topic for a moment, there were other blog posts about this from Jeff Waugh and Dave Neary, and I posted all these into a LibreOffice document, and counted up. There were, of these four blog posts, in these four blog posts, 11,146 words of just discussions and arguments about the free software desktop.
Wow.
11,000?
11,000.
That's even longer than the GNU / Linux naming controversy FAQ.
That is, which in turn is even longer than the US Constitution, I believe. yeah, so that's a lot of 11,000 words of people arguing about something that boils down to status indications on the desktop. That scares me.
Jeff Waugh, is that the Jeff Waugh's timeline? The part of the timeline where it discusses Canonical's contribution. I think it just almost be getting to some kind of head, because GNOME 3 is obviously on the horizon as in Ubuntu 11.04. Mark Shuttleworth even commented on Jeff Waugh's comments. And the two of them, considering Jeff Waugh used to work for Canonical, they seem at loggerheads with one another, where Jeff Waugh on the one side is saying Canonical has never done enough to ensure its developers work with upstream GNOME developers, and Mark Shuttleworth is saying, well, we'll get back to this, I'm sure. Mark Shuttleworth is saying quite the opposite. And it must just be because there's so much duplicated effort that's just on the horizon, GNOME 3 and Ubuntu 11.04.
Yeah. Is this healthy? I mean, you look at... We all want Linux to succeed on the desktop. We want a united front for it. And this is a completely fractured, disorganized front at the moment. We've got KDE, we've got Unity, we've got GNOME Shell, we've got the old GNOME design. Yeah. We've got what Unity might fall back to if you haven't got a 3D graphics card.
Unity, it's getting 2D, more splintered. Using Qt.
Yeah, using Qt, using extra RAM, extra libraries. And, you know, Google came along for Android. They said, right, we'll take the great, powerful, stable, secure Linux kernel, and we'll put a whole new interface layer on top of that that's consistent from the top to the bottom, without all these different layers and abstractions and duplications. I wonder if it'll come to their head. I wonder if a splinter group will come off from GNOME and KDE and say, look, you know, enough of this argument. Let's make the best Linux desktop.
I think, actually, if the innovation in GNOME 3 or was clearly obvious, or if the innovation in Ubuntu 11.04 was clearly obvious, nobody would have a problem. I think the problem is that there isn't any clear winner. There's no clear reason to use one over the other, so everyone's kind of arguing about it.
Yeah, it's really, really bad. And in the last decade, we've just been arguing about these different things on the desktop. We haven't put together a full cohesive experience. Apple went along and made iOS and sold 100 million devices, and we're still arguing about status indicators and window managers and the like. It's not good. Moving on, but here's some good news on the desktop. Moving on to GTK 3.2, which is due out soon, sometime, whenever, I don't know. But it's going to have the ability to run GTK applications via a web browser. It currently only works in Firefox 4.0, and this is using GTK's new Broadway backend. But you launch a GTK app using this Broadway backend, and it shows absolutely nothing. But then you go to localhost in your web browser, and a certain port, you need to enable WebSockets in Firefox, and the application appears there in your browser, a bit like VNC. But
does that mean that the GTK kind of widget toolset is actually embedded in Firefox somehow, so that when you call a call for a file requester, for example, it's actually opening a native GTK file requester through Firefox?
I don't know. I wouldn't think so, because that wouldn't work on Firefox on Windows.
It would if they had actually the GTK libraries.
I believe it's... maybe it is. I think Canvas has got something to do with it, but I watched a demonstration on the website of... on the GTK website of a guy using a GNOME calculator and it popping up in his Firefox session, and it looked responsive. And
actually, I mean, that would actually work well with GNOME Shell. I mean, if you could actually forget about VNC and all the rest of it, but the GNOME Shell UI would actually work really well within a web browser window.
Whoa.
Because, and then you've got complete access to your system. That actually makes some sense.
Wow. silence as we all stroke our chins and think about what we've been missing.
A desktop inside a web browser inside another desktop.
I mean, I complain about GNOME Shell's use of screen real estate, but in fact, if you can restrict it to a window in your web browser, that's a solution.
That would be pretty cool. Another piece of news, the Debian Derivatives Exchange project, or DEX, has launched, and it's attempting to merge changes in Debian-derived distros back into Debian itself. It started off as a joint project between Debian and Ubuntu developers, but the Debian teams looked and saw that there are over 300 distributions based on Debian, 300 active distributions, and a lot of them make lots of different changes that don't actually find their way back into Debian itself. Yeah. So this new site, they've said it helps them to helps distros to cooperate with Debian by providing informational resources, a point of contact, and a discussion forum for derivatives.
Oh, God. More discussion.
That's just what we need, isn't it? Another 11,000 words of discussion. I think it's a pretty good thing, though, if it gets... A lot of these small spin-off distros might be doing some really cool things.
And I think, for Debian, it's a great idea, because it's the first time that they're probably thinking, you know, something, maybe those derivative distributions have stolen some of our thunder and we'd like to be a little bit more dynamic.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're owed many of those contributions. It could make Debian even better. It could, you know, it could fill the gap that Ubuntu is prying apart.
Yeah. But it's great for Ubuntu as well, because Ubuntu gets all sorts of brickbats thrown at it for not contributing enough, you know, as we'll see in the open banner, and as we've just heard in the first news story, people criticize it for that. But one of the two chaps that are organizing this project are Matt Zimmerman, who is the CTO of Canonical.
Oh, yeah.
And Stefano Zaccarelli, the current Debian project leader. So it's quite, you know, high-end, big decision makers.
Was it Matt Zimmerman who left a comment on our Tuxedo open palette?
He did. He left a comment.
Did he?
Yes, he left a comment saying that this is not an official project in Canonical, like we might have implied. But nonetheless, it's still a bunch of developers working on it. So, you know, it's the Canonical staff who was helping.
So we can only assume they'll be listening to this Canonical sponsored podcast.
Matt Zimmerman, not verified, so it might not have been him.
It might be somebody. It might be Bill Gates.
Just to clarify, DEX is not a Canonical project. It is a joint project between Debian and Ubuntu developers.
Cool. Cheers, Matt. Oh, and one more news story. Of course, Firefox 4 is out. Hooray!
Hooray! Woo! That's great!
Yay! Just one of the many releases they plan to bring out this year as they accelerate the version
number. Yeah, it's kind of diminished our excitement for 4, because 4 should be a massive news story. It should be brilliant. But now we're all thinking, well, we'll celebrate 4 today, but next month we'll be celebrating 5? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm looking forward to trying it out, because I've been using Chrome now for about a year and a half, 2 years, because it's unbelievably fast. But Firefox is supposed to get a lot of that speed back, especially in JavaScript.
Yes, and what's even more impressive is that there are kind of movements in the Google team to kind of address some of the issues that Firefox 4 has highlighted in their code, which is great, because we haven't seen that kind of competition feedback system for a while.
Exactly, yeah. These are great times for the browser world. Look at the stagnation in the early 2000s when everyone was using IE6.
Yeah, and nothing worked if you're on a Linux box. Yeah. You know, you could not access your bank account, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You just don't come across that anymore. I don't come across any site that says it needs ActiveX or
IE4.
I'm looking forward to giving it a try, and also because I really like Chrome and I like Google in general, but year by year they just seem to be creeping more and more into my soul and taking more and more of my information. with tracking everything and Google Mail, and so
all power to the Mozilla Foundation.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, that was brilliant. Thanks, Mike. It's now time for the discovery of the fortnight.
Yay! That's your favourite section, isn't it?
It is my favourite section. I was reluctant to say it then, because I feel I might be annoying people, you know. So I was just going to keep quiet.
Annoying.
But it is my favourite section, yeah.
Cool.
Because I'm usually so bad at it. It really is
masochism.
A case of going back to my computer in the morning of a podcast and pressing up in my terminal prompt to see what it is I've actually been doing. I have actually got one.
Whoa!
But, you know, I don't know. Someone else want to go first?
you go first.
Okay, well, mine is pretty specific, but what it is that in February, Spotify, which in the UK and other parts of Europe is a fantastic music streaming service, released an ARM compiled library for accessing its API. This means that lots of ARM-powered Linux NAS boxes running Squeezebox can now access Spotify music straight from the NAS box without any kind of supporting hardware or PC running, which, if you like music and you find Spotify is good value for money, is fantastic news. And it's great that Spotify is supporting Linux. There's a Linux client as well. But I think the ARM library is even better. And if they could just add a PowerPC library for the remainder of NAS boxes that use PowerPC architecture, then it would be even better. That's my discovery.
There are NAS boxes out there using PowerPC.
Well, yeah, they use. It's like many of the ARM derivatives, you know, they're loosely based on PowerPC. That's the kind of architecture they fall under. But, you know,
right,
they're not actually running the same G4 processor or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, lots of Synology and QNAP devices use PowerPC
CPUs.
Great.
I just always like having other architectures out there. I'd hate a world which was just x86.
Well, yeah.
No, ARM is really big now as well. But
initially, there was just an Intel-only library, which is fair enough. You could run Spotify on your netbook. But yeah, the fact that, and it actually works. I've tried it on a QNAP NAS box. You don't have to do anything either. The way Squeezebox works, which is Logitech's music server streaming software, there's the Linux version. You just have to enable the plugin, it downloads the library, and you can listen to music from Spotify on your Linux NAS. It's really cool.
Your house must be amazing with all these NAS boxes and everything connected around.
It's pretty minimal. It's pretty minimal. I've got a Squeezebox Classic from a long time ago that I still use, attached to a NAS box, yeah.
Cool.
But it's just brilliant now. I can just page through music on Spotify and listen to it. It's 320 kilobits per second, really high quality. It's an Ogg Vorbis codec, so it's great.
Cool. Well, I found the longest video on YouTube.
Did you come to the end of YouTube?
I come to the end of the internet, and I defeated the final boss. Well, there are lots of videos claiming to be the longest video on YouTube. It's like 24 hours or even some that are 36 hours. But I found one that's 478 hours long. It's called Origami Box Destroy. And it has a thumbnail of something happening. But when you load it, for a couple of minutes, it shows random colours flashing on the screen. And then for the next 19 days, it just shows a solid green screen. And what it looks like is YouTube's encoder has messed up. It's taken someone's video of somebody breaking a box or making a box. And then has completely muffed it all up and separated each frame into some full block of colour. And that's why it goes on for 478 hours, 48 minutes and 5 seconds.
So the original movie wasn't that long?
I would assume so.
That also sounds like there's a potential for an exploit on Google's YouTube conversion service,
yeah,
doesn't it? Well, you could probably bring down Google.
What's that? Oh, I can hear helicopters.
You didn't hear that, listeners. You didn't hear anything. So that's pretty cool. Yeah, Origami Box Destroy.
I thought you were going to say it was you staring at the screen for 17 days. That's what you did with your 2-week holiday.
I never went to Munich after all.
Like those YouTube videos that show people growing their beards one day at a time. But you've actually done it in real time.
It's lovely, isn't it?
Mike has got a bit of a beard at the moment.
I have actually, yeah. I haven't shaved for
3 days.
And my second discovery is, does everybody remember the Great Guyana Sisters?
Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah, it's a platform game that came out in probably the late 80s.
Yeah.
It was a complete rip-off of Super Mario Brothers, down to the level design and everything. But it was released for a few other computers, like the Commodore.
For the Amiga and the 64.
Yeah, but Nintendo's legal team came down like a ton of bricks on them.
But it was so playable in just the same way that Super Mario Brothers was. It was a genuinely great game.
I never played it at the time. I remember hearing about it, but I couldn't get hold of a copy, so... Mm. Did it have all the quality playability?
It did. I genuinely played it. And really got into it. I'd never actually played a Nintendo console at that stage. So to me, it was my first kind of experience of that kind of gameplay, and it was utterly genuine. It was brilliant, really good fun. Cool. And too short, as I remember, and great music.
Right. Well, there's something called Guyana's Return now, which is an unofficial sequel that I came across. If you want to try this, listeners, be careful, because it's... The zip file is like a tar bomb. It extracts everything in the current directory and making a complete mess of your desktop. So extract it into a separate folder. But it looks pretty good. It's a heavily Mario-inspired platformer, but that's good in my book. So
yeah,
give it a go. There's a Linux binary available on their site.
That silence means it's it must be time for me to say what I've discovered this fortnight. In the Linux world, I discovered a couple of months ago that GNOME 3, GNOME Shell, doesn't work properly on my machine. And a couple of days ago, I discovered that Unity doesn't work properly on my machine. Woohoo! Presumably for the same 3D graphics acceleration related reasons. But the fallback that's in the alpha of Ubuntu 11.04 that I tried defaults back to GNOME, but without the nice human theming. So it's just the generic right-angled, really early 90s looking GTK, which just looks dreadful. It looks worse than any improvements that might have possibly been gained from Unity. It's the opposite of progress.
Well, it just looks Mike and I were poop. Talking about this earlier, yesterday actually. It looks like they're going to do... There's a Qt version of Unity 2D, and it looks like that'll be the fallback.
Because they've just not put it into the alpha yet.
No, you have to actually install it through a PPA. I don't know why.
That's
madness. But it looks identical to the 3D-enabled Unity. Identical and almost as nice, if that's what you like.
Like shadows?
No, it doesn't have any of that.
Right.
But in terms of looking the same and offering the same functionality, it seems identical. It doesn't have any of the, you know, the compiz-enabled effects.
Well, that's good, because it means that if you're writing a guide or a book...
Yes, it should be operationally the same.
Yeah, that's good. But why did they have to use Qt? Why did they have to introduce another 50 megs of RAM usage for the libraries?
I don't know, and I think it's using QML. I might be wrong.
Right.
So it's the very latest kind of Qt technology, or Qt, as we've been told to pronounce it.
It does seem strange that if it falls back to 2D mode because you haven't got a 3D graphics card, or your 3D graphics card isn't working that well, then it probably means you're running an older machine with fewer resources. Mm. So to then load all the Qt libraries into RAM at the same time, kind of...
That's true.
Counterintuitive.
Yeah.
Maybe they're thinking of cross-platform compatibility, you know, because that's the great advantage, that's the main advantage to using Qt. No, Windows version.
Mate, yeah.
Well, they're probably not thinking of the poor villagers in Africa anymore with their knackered old recycled hardware.
No.
They're not thinking of poor writers in Bath.
With ancient Dell computers that nobody else wants.
Yeah. I think you found for me under a pile of boxes. Oh, look at this. Other discoveries. Berlin is still very nice. Mm. The mojitos in the bar at the top of the Fernsehturm are very enjoyable.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it is.
Can I just point out the Bratislava school as well?
Majestically cool. Effie, have you been to any international city beginning with B?
Ever.
Apart from Bristol.
Bristol, yeah, I was going to say that. I got to think about this. Barcelona.
That's a lovely place.
That's all right, yeah. Well, that's it.
Cool. Moving on, then.
Haven't you got an awesome discovery?
I have discovered that I've been talking rubbish for the last 3 podcasts.
We weren't going to say anything, you know.
I think you're really polite, and I really thank you for that. But the reason why is because I've been whinging about the awareness of Linux and open source and free software in Latin America, and I just came across with the biggest installation fest in the world.
Whoa.
And it's called FliSol, and it's organized in the whole Latin America and Spain. is going to be held on the 9th of April this year, and it's going to be simultaneously held in about 11 countries.
Whoa.
In Latin America and Spain.
That's amazing.
That is just...
What's it called?
FLISOL.
What does that mean?
FLISOL stands for, in Spanish, Festival Latinoamericano de Instalación de Software Libre. And what happens is that it's been running since 2005. Every year they do it in April. And this year it's going to be a different date. Normally it was the... I'll tell you what, when is it? It was the last Saturday of April, but for some reason this year it's going to be on the 9th of April specifically.
Maybe because
of Easter. Yeah, probably that's why. And what happens is that every single country, and I'm going to name you which country size: Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Costa Rica, Cuba, Ecuador, Spain, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, Nicaragua, Panama, Paraguay, Peru, República Dominicana, Uruguay, Venezuela. All these countries are hosting this event in different cities, and each city has different venues that are taking part on
That's
this
amazing.
Installation fest.
That's really cool.
Just to give you an example of how big this thing is, I'm just baffled by this thing. Thinking about the awareness of the subject matter in Latin America. Just in Mexico, there are 20 cities and towns hosting this event. Just in Mexico City, there are 7 venues. Right? Well, actually, no. 7 districts in Mexico City are doing it. And 3 districts have 3 venues in average. Just the closest to my original neighborhood, it's just got one single venue, which is the National Telecommunications Building. And the event is going to be the whole day, and they got speakers from... This is just it's just amazing. They got people from Novell, Red Hat, Ericsson, some graphics companies that are going to be talking about the GIMP and Inkscape and so on and so on. So it's not just about the installation.
So there's an install fest as well.
It's an install fest, but it's not just that. They've got workshops, they've got general talks about each area of Linux and open source and free software. Also, they've got after event talks and discussions. So if you're a newbie on this subject, and you go and bring your laptop, install, say for instance, I don't know, openoffice.org, they give you a crash course on how to use it, how to install it, how to use it. Off you go back home, and then you get stuck on, I don't know, on spreadsheets. You can always go back to the website and get support from the organizers of the event in your locality.
That's huge.
It's just massive.
Has it been done? How has it been organized?
I got no clue. I was trying to listen to a podcast from the people that organized the event. I mean, it's been running since 2005, and no one knows about it.
No,
it's just crazy. It's only this. Everything is in Spanish anyway. Sorry, I have to clarify this. But I've been whinging about the awareness of all this in Latin America, and it's there. It's been there since 2005. This event is just massive. How do you organize and synchronize so many countries, so many events, so many venues?
Yeah, I don't.
I got they know no clue. Party, and they? All of them are going to be linked online.
Cool.
They're supposed to be linked online. And if you are, if you're going to wine,
go
exactly. if you go into one of the venues, you don't have to pay. It's free. You just bring your laptop or your massive computer, and they teach you how to install free software.
What do we have here in the UK? Little Linux user groups.
Yeah.
I'll have a pint of bitter. And
that does sound awesome. That sounds like we should try and cover it somehow.
You can send me to Mexico City on the 9th of April, and I'll find out.
I'd send you.
If anybody wants to donate to our podcast,
to Effie's Go Back to Mexico Fund.
Please.
I'll start it.
I promise I'll take some pictures. I'll take some video as well.
Yeah.
I've got some money as well.
Well, I'll keep the £2 coin, but you can have 90 pence.
Oh, that'll do it. That pays for my...
I've got 20 euro cents.
Oh, that's... I can go and cover it in Spain, and that covers for at least a bottle of beer.
If we get if your Latin American compatriots manage to get Shakira and Salma Hayek to convert to Linux Mint,
we can
finally get some hot chicks on the cover of Linux Fun,
which
has been the dream for some time.
Most grateful for. Definitely. Yeah. I just talked to the guys in Colombia and Mexicans from Colombia.
the Colombia massive.
But it's just, I just find it absolutely baffling.
Like I said,
you just have to go to the website and just basically check it out for yourself. And I just came across this by chance, really. I was looking for something in the Fedora website and it was listed on the events. So hemos llegado a la sección más apreciada de todos nosotros. La sección favorita de todos nosotros es... Tú nos dice un reto.
Gole, 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 gole.
Butros, butros, gali.
What's the Spanish for fail?
Fallaste. O
fallaste.
Fallaste. Sorry about
dog
that.
Dog.
Yeah. Dog. This is our favorite section. You dare us. That is, you dare us.
Yay! That's my other favorite section. Done. So what were we dared to do then last time?
Come up with a new slogan for Linux. Linux have a slogan?
I thought it was for Linux format. Sorry.
No. Andrew came up with a cunning plan that if we came up with any good ideas,
I've been working on the premises that it worked for Linux. I fail.
Just take the word magazine out of your slogan, and then it will be fine. All right then. I came up with because your computer belongs to you.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
I thought you could say because you're worth it.
Yeah. That was mine.
That's far better. My slogan it tries to work in two ways. In one way, saying that you shouldn't have your computer overridden by spyware and malware and things like that. You should have control of it. But also on a more deeper kind of DRM level and toying and hacking type of level. You've bought a computer. You don't want to be running software on it that you're ultimately renting. When you sign the license agreement for Windows or OS X, you don't own the software. You're just renting the right to use it from a faceless company.
Yeah, and you're not even owning the content anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Your own font content is now somewhere.
There are lots of blurry lines about what is yours and what you can actually do with your stuff. So I think saying, because your computer belongs to you, is you've gone out and bought this machine. That is yours now. If you run Linux on it, it is totally yours. You're not renting, you're not borrowing, you're not accidentally pirating by sharing a song with a friend. This is your machine.
Yeah.
And you control it, and it is your destiny. So there we go.
That's pretty good.
Thanks.
Mine's a bit of a cliche. Mine was just the open source.
The open source.
Yeah, because I think open source is our greatest asset. And thanks to the likes of Firefox and LibreOffice, OpenOffice, you know, it's what people find most attractive, I think, or should find most attractive about Linux and free software. Mm. It's just trying to reinforce that this is it. This is the end result, that you can trust it because it's open. You know, everything's open about it, from the standards that applications use to the code that's used to run the software.
Hmm. I don't know if Richard Stallman would be happy with the
open source. No, well... That's exactly the problem. If we put free software, blah, 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 you know, my mum's not going to understand. Oh, it's free.
Yeah.
No, free as in beer, mum.
Yeah. That's a point I put to Stallman, which will be in our interview in Linux Format issue 145, that free software makes people think of Windows spyware and crap like that.
And not paying anything for it.
Yeah, not paying anything. Stuff that you just grab off the internet. So anyway, yeah, that's pretty cool. Maybe we can combine all these together as we build them up. Andrew's looking very philosophical there.
I'm staring at the wall over at the far side of the boardroom, which is where we're recording the podcast today, looking for inspiration. There appear to be stills from other future magazines.
Cool.
There are some pixies and fairies, which have come from SFX. There's a woman wearing a cardigan, where I assume that's come from some knitting magazine or other. It's not really helping me at all.
There's a lovely flip chart there with a graph with no actual text on the axes.
See, maybe that's... Well, I'm not going to criticise the people who normally do flip charts in the boardroom, but whenever you see a graph that's not been labelled properly on the axes, you do sort of wonder. Come on, lads.
I thought it was the picture of a cityscape in perspective.
Maybe
the
it
road,
is.
The road, the buildings and all that.
Oh, hang on. No, yeah. There's a picture of... Is that Malcolm...
Malcolm McDowell.
Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah.
In that case, kneel before Tux. There you go.
Or ultraviolence.
Good bit of the old ultraviolence. Okay, so we've got a kneel before Tux, because your computer belongs to you, and the open source. That just leaves Effie's suggestion.
Well, I thought about a different one, just Linux sets you free.
Sets you free.
Sets you free, that's it.
That's good.
Like Simon Bolivar.
No. Just like Braveheart.
Or Bernardo O'Higgins.
They will never take our freedom. Yeah. It's just very simple.
They will never take our freedom. That's another good one. Cool. So if any...
Not so bad, actually, considering we all came into this room with probably Mike the only one who'd actually prepared anything.
I wrote mine yesterday. Yeah. I did.
Well done, Mike.
Stroke of inspiration. So I think we can have a little challenge for the listeners here now. They've heard all our suggestions, and maybe the listeners can combine them all into one super mega slogan. One that encapsulates everything, all the ideas and all the free software love that we've put together.
So did you come up with any slogan for the magazine, for Linux Forum magazine?
No, I didn't even know we made a magazine.
How about for the slogan that encapsulates Linux, how about, but it didn't ask me for a password?
What about FTW? Linux Forum for the win.
T3H. Tailwind. All right then, so we need another challenge, and thinking that Firefox 4 has been released, and a lot of us are using Chrome now, all the versions of Firefox, why don't we set that as a challenge? Let's use Firefox 4 exclusively for the next 2 weeks, test out its performance, see how well we get along with it, and its extensions and features and everything.
It's a great idea. See how it compares with older versions of Firefox for everything and Chrome for us.
Yeah, see if it's faster than Chrome, then I'll be hooked on it.
Okay, brilliant.
Cool. And at this point, we come to the two-thirds, three-quarters point of this podcast. Still coming up, we've got Graham Morrison in the dock and, of course, the results of our open ballot. Right, so it's Graham Morrison in the dock. Graham Morrison will now have 1 minute to defend a point of view.
Okay, yeah.
What's it going to be?
It's going to be that the command line isn't scary.
Isn't scary.
It's not scary. No. People should not be afraid of the command line.
It is.
I'm just scared when you say the word.
For reasons I'm about to outline.
Okay. This is.
Okay.
Okay. I will get the timer ready on this Android phone. 3, 2, 1. Go.
When I first started using computers, it was an Acorn Electron. The thing that really excited me about the Acorn Electron was the flashing basic prompt. It just seemed like a portal to a world of infinite possibilities. And I think the command line on the Linux desktop is the same thing. You don't need to be scared of it. There's nothing you can do that will really do any harm as long as you do things in a safe environment. And also, it gives you the ultimate power of control over your whole system. You can start with little baby steps such as simple file management tools, tools like LS or Move or any of the copying directories, it's because it's so explicit, you can usually see exactly what's happening. And then you can move from those baby steps to slightly more advanced commands, or even trying to pipe commands, or trying to do small little scripts. At the end of the day, it's one of the best aspects of the Linux operating system, and it's something that should be a real advantage rather than something people should be afraid of. And we should make better use of introducing people and getting them to ease their fears away.
Wow, 1 minute up. That was a perfect fit.
Yeah.
Nice one. So what do you think, listeners? Did Graham convince you in that 1 minute?
Let's go for a pint.
Incidentally, the first computer I ever used was an Acorn Electron as well.
Yeah.
It was absolutely ace. I like the way
they're a bit rubbish, really.
Oh, I don't.
But you could play Elite on them, so that made everything all right.
And Chucky Egg.
And Chucky Egg. And the sound the Electron made, actually, when the little Chucky thing moved around, it's awesome. It was like almost like a hardware tick, because the sound was really crude on Electron.
Well, it came out of the device itself, didn't it?
Yeah. And then
that's so close to Rubber Boys.
Oh.
Yeah, it actually had a buzzer inside the machine, didn't it?
Yeah,
Are you sure it wasn't a mouse stuck in electronics? Or a gerbil or a hamster?
Right, now it's time for Open Ballot, sponsored by Canonical.
We wish.
The question was... Bob, what was the question? Here we go. Do you think, on the whole, that Canonical is a good or bad force for free software and Linux? And the results of our open ballot are overwhelmingly that Canonical is a good force for free software and Linux.
That's brilliant.
So, see you next fortnight.
That is now officially a fact, not opinion.
We can add it to Wikipedia.
Yeah.
That's I'm massively awesome for that. Oh, I've found another discovery, which I wrote on this piece of paper.
Cool, let's hear it. Late. No. It's never too late.
While I was looking up who Stefano Zaccaroli was, on his Wikipedia page at the bottom, there's where there's the categories and things. It says categories: Debian project leaders, Italian computer programmers, living people, free software programmers.
Living people is a category.
How
Wikipedia.
Many people are in that?
Brilliant.
And what happens if you take somebody out? Do they die in real life? Is it like a voodoo doll?
Maybe that's something for you, dare us.
Remove somebody from living people.
What if Mike Saunders isn't on the Wikipedia's living people list?
I don't think I'm on. There is a Mike Saunders who's a heavy metal drummer. I think he's got the Mike Saunders entry on Wikipedia. He's, damn him.
Is he the real Mike Saunders on Twitter or something? Anyway, yes, appears to be the answer. 27 votes to... 10 against. Quite overwhelming when you look at just at the numbers, but the numbers don't tell the story. We've had so many well thought out, nuanced, rounded answers to this that I do recommend that after you've finished listening to the podcast, you go back onto Tux Radar and read the thread.
It's brilliant. It's really, really surprising. Just how serious people take the question as well, and how much general positivity there is for what Canonical has done.
Yeah, the answers were great. And there was one point where I got a bit scared, where somebody wrote, "Let's not forget that Canonical, whilst bankrolled by MS, is still a business." And I spent about half an hour thinking, I can't believe this guy believes that Canonical is bankrolled by Microsoft. And I really thought it was some incredible rant. And
yeah, sorry about that.
Until I realised he was talking about Mark Shuttleworth, the other MS.
Ah.
So, yeah, it shows just how cynical I've got.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. You expect it, don't you?
Yeah. So, what have we got? What's some quality choices, picks from?
Well, I've grouped together a few comments that were seem to touch upon Ubuntu's Ubuntu's contributions or non-contributions to Linux. First of these is from Anonymous Penguin. I will dignify Anonymous Penguin by reading out what he said. He's just really given a link to Greg Croer Hartman's speech, keynote speech, in which he criticised Ubuntu for not making enough contributions to the Linux kernel. And then underneath that, there are lots of people who've either made the same contribution or have preempted that criticism.
Nye says, I don't understand most of the arguments regarding them being bad. My favourite complaint of all time is that they have never done anything in the way of patches to the kernel. I'm going to make a wild guess that this is probably an understatement in that 90% of distributions never have.
It's probably true when you take 90% of the distro watch list.
Yeah, well, given that there are 12,000 distros out there, that's probably going to be the case.
And then down below this, Linux Lover says in riposte, first of all, I just want to say that yes, 90% of all the distributions out there have not submitted patches to the kernel or developed for it at all. The difference is that those are community distros. There is a certain burden when you're the number one distro. You need to contribute to the ecosystem. They don't. Second, the kernel isn't the least bit of it. Their submissions to GNOME, KDE and other projects are dismal. The only development they've done is for their own good. They even go so far as to act like technology they begin adding to their distro, such as Wayland, is something that they created, except that they didn't.
I think it's a bit harsh to level criticism that they haven't contributed anything to the kernel, because they are making, they are repackaging Debian and making a shiny desktop operating system out of it. I mean, Red Hat makes a lot of contributions to the kernel, but that's fair enough because they're in a totally different world. They're tuning Linux for enterprise systems. They're adding new hardware support and file systems and things, whereas the Ubuntu Oracle team aren't. It's not like they've come up with all this great kernel technology and they're not releasing it.
I suppose it could be argued that Red Hat makes so many contributions, both to the desktop and to the kernel, that they don't have to do that for their business model, you know, something that they've always done. And I guess if you judge distributions by the number of people using them rather than the number of distributions, then it's easy to see why people feel that Canonical and Ubuntu should have some kind of responsibility, considering so many people use it in proportion to, say, Fedora or Red Hat and the majority of other distributions.
I just mean, you know, they can't come up with kernel patches for the sake of it if they're not really making that many changes.
Right. Lots of praise for Canonical. Hear me now, says Lee Nukes. In my opinion, Canonical is good for free software, although in some cases they have been the big business rather than the caring friend. As long as they keep things open to change, it's better to have developers working on their own goals towards their own distro than no one working on no distro. Fair enough. Dave S. says, a huge proportion of the computing fraternity have no idea what free software is. Ubuntu has a high enough profile to tempt some of these folks into the water. That alone makes them a positive force in my book. Most people who've praised Ubuntu and Canonical have given that for their reason, that they've made it more accessible and highlighted the availability of free software. Tuxman says, it's all about the colour. What happened to the colour? Only reason I used Ubuntu was the nice colour. Please go back to brown.
Oh.
All that moaning that we did about the brown.
Yeah. back to the business side of things. Tony Hughes of Blackpool Lug says, let's not forget that Canonical, while bankrolled by MS, hang on.
Deja vu.
Hang on, enough of that.
I think that the problem that people have probably with Canonical is that we all want Linux to succeed. We don't just want Ubuntu to succeed. Ubuntu and Canonical are standing on the shoulders of everybody who's made Linux and free software possible. And if it was the only distribution left, Linux wouldn't win. You know, and I guess that's how people feel, that there's an obligation that they need to fold back some of that back into the community, even though they don't have any legal obligation. I personally think that Canonical and Ubuntu has been a good thing for free software, just for in the same way that lots of other people have said it, because it's brought Linux to the mainstream. It's enabled lots of people to use Linux and to start to understand free software and realize that it's not all geeky and about the command line. And however way they decide to do that or how to run the business, the bottom line is that's the end effect.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting as well that Canonical have given away Linux CDs through the Ship It program.
Yeah,
I think,
yeah.
You know, that hasn't mattered much to those of us sitting on super fast broadband connections with CD burners coming out the wazoo, but the fact that you could just go to the site and say, please send me the CD, and then you will get a product, a shiny product in a shiny little package that's official, and they will send you that for free. And it's a thing that's just as powerful as your Windows installation, a lot more powerful, really. And they will just post that to you. And, you know, people all around the world could receive free software, even people with dial-up, people with no internet connections, they could get.
Yeah.
I think that was good. I mean, you know, it's in their own interest. Like you say, they're a company. They want to make money. They want an image. But if the end result is getting free software out there...
But I think... Yeah, so I think Graham's has got he's made a good point. Is that from a newbie point of view, is the accessibility into the world of Linux that is required? And I think Canonical and Ubuntu have provided that. Most of the people that I know that have joined this environment have done it through using Ubuntu. So it's just how accessible Linux is for the newbies, and I think that's the first step. After that, then you can probably decide what you want to do. No?
Sultan of Swing says,
"Cool.
I think we've become used to playing second fiddle to the big boys, but I think we should also feel very proud to support Canonical with their endeavours. If we hadn't made Ubuntu the top distro and allowed it to innovate, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
Yeah.
What's worse, questioning Canonical's support for free software or sitting in our basements wishing that we had such a big issue worth
that's
discussing?"
True, that's a really good point.
It is true, but then immediately followed by Theseus, the G-Zeus. Proprietary MP3 and DVD playback is validating software patents. He's presumably talking about the Ubuntu Music Store, the way that Ubuntu makes it easy to install codecs when you first install it.
Sounds like it.
It's validating software patents and selling proprietary music, and they use proprietary server-side software for their cloud storage. No good.
They've always used, Launchpad for a long time was proprietary. You know, that used to bug us.
Yes.
But you know, it's the same thing. My feeling is that Mark Shuttleworth has, a long time ago, decided that what would make Linux successful was if a small group of motivated developers actually basically forked it and made it usable regardless of what the rest of the community thinks. And in a similar way to Apple being so... uncompromising with its user interface guidelines. It seems that if you did that in the Linux community, such as involving the GNOME developers, it might not happen. And because of free software open source, he was able to do this, able to create a team of developers, say, look, we want to make usability the key feature. Don't worry about upstream, don't worry about anything else, just make it work. And this, the downside is that you might create some bad will and friction with the community, but the good side is that you do have the Ubuntu desktop.
Yes.
Well, Johnville reckons that ultimately Canonical are a business. Money is in charge of Canonical, not freedom. In the short term, it's all been great, but every time you took a piecemeal gift, they were filling their future coffers. Canonical,
well, they're not making money, are they?
Well, yeah. Canonical are the free software version of a self-service checkout. You do the work so they don't have to.
If they were making... I mean, maybe it's got to the point where Canonical... And I have no idea. But maybe it's got to the point that they're saying, look, if we carry on like this, there won't be Ubuntu.
Yeah.
So it's either try and make more money out of it or we'll leave it to the Debians and the Fedoras of this world.
Certainly, if I'd made 400-odd million pounds in my 20s, I don't think I'd be coordinating a global software project.
What would you be doing?
Yeah, what would you be doing?
Let's not think about
it. Please, I want to know.
Won the lottery.
Let me not torture myself with that. But he's presumably not doing it to annoy people who don't like Unity. Otherwise, it's a hugely expensive trolling activity. Stephen Michael Kellett says... And I've written very good points in Biro on this, just to remind myself to read it out. Historically, churches have split in America over picayune issues, like whether or not the church building should have indoor plumbing or whether there should be Sunday school classes. The recent news erupting about Canonical is nothing new and is found in any corporate entity, whether it is a community of faith or a community of software. Then again, how often are those two things different in the FOSS world? In our imperfect world, Canonical is a good thing for free software. Fumbles and foul steps, such as the Banshee GNOME
funding nonsense are part of life, especially relative to the operation of organisations.
Yeah, very rounded.
I think that's...
Yeah.
Well, this is it. Maybe a lot of these debates go on internally in other companies as well. We were talking about the splintering of the Linux desktop before and the problems, but maybe similar things happen internally in Microsoft.
Oh, I'm sure. Apple. We see a
shinier product from them, a more unified product, but I'm sure they probably have big arguments as well. Perhaps in a way it's our strength that even if there are 11,000 words of arguments out there, at least people are arguing in the open. We can all see it.
I think it's very valuable that people get together and actually meet face to face, because it's too easy to actually say all this stuff online semi-anonymously or
with emote icons.
Maybe that's something Canonical could do. Which they do. I mean, they do sponsor Guardic and Academy, and they do help people get to places when they need to.
That's cool.
Can we give the last word, please, to Linux Lover, who says, if you love Linux, you owe it to yourself to shed the leeches of Canonical and Ubuntu. Full stop, new sentence. That's just my opinion.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a really positive thing. I mean, in general, what we've read has been such well-argued cases for kind of Canonical's position and what they've done, and there's a generally more understanding than maybe we often give the internet credit for. You know, I think it's good for Canonical.
I think Mark Shuttleworth has to toe a very careful line. I think it could be quite easy for Canonical to be seen as too much leeching off free software or abusing its position. So I think, he's a businessman. He's got money interests at heart, but I think he's playing quite a canny long-term game here. So we'll see how it pans out.
And that brings us to the end of episode 6, series 3.
Can you guess what's coming here, Graham? You knew this was going to happen.
I didn't actually know until that very moment.
Really?
What is it? What's going on?
The one more thing. I know, this is really, truly, honestly our favourite section of the show.
It is, you're right.
Yeah. Here's a little test for you then. We were talking about YouTube earlier. When was the first YouTube video uploaded?
2005.
It was actually 2005, it was a video called Me at the Zoo. Some guy standing in front of elephants, I think, and that was the 23rd of April 2005.
Honestly, it was only 2005.
Only 2005, only 6 years old, YouTube, even though it seems like it's been around forever.
Yeah. That's what the internet, what use was the internet before YouTube?
I don't know, there was that ASCII version of the World Cup in Telnet.
Oh, that was ace.
Yeah, but that was the only video on the internet before then. And here's another question then. How many hours are a new video are uploaded to YouTube every minute?
Every minute.
Oh, that's a good question.
How many hours?
1,000.
Nope.
512.
65,000.
There's actually only 35 hours.
Who was closer?
I win.
Andrew was closest, and also had a computing significant number as well. So, excellent. So please carry on uploading stuff, listeners, and see if you can beat the Origami Box Destroy video 478 hours. We'll give you special credit if so. And thanks for listening. We've had great fun here, and tune in again in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Adios.
Bye.